Mr. Batson, Rio 5. Now, since I last saw you, you've had a look and found some of the rest of your crew you want to tell us about them. Well,
starting from the top, Lieutenant I.B. Anderson, he was a skipper. Then Sub-Lieutenant P.J.C. Dark. Then Sub-Lieutenant P.W. Landy, Royal Australian Navy. The leading seaman coxswain was Sergeant. A.L. Bennett was Petty Officer Motor Mechanic. W.K. Sparks, Able Seaman. A.V. Alder, Able Seaman. R.H. Newman, who was a New Zealander, he was a telegraphist. And G. Rees was ordinary seaman, ASDICS operator. T.N. Garner, ordinary seaman, he was the other gunner, my opposite number.
He was on the front gun?
Yeah, he was on the forward gun. And then there's R. Battison, ordinary seaman, I was on the rear gun. And E.A. Butcher, stoker, second class. Then Adam Ritchie, stoker, second class. And Arthur Shepherd, ordinary seaman. And right up to the raid, we always had one man short. And when they made us up to 14 on the raid by bringing this Lieutenant Landy on board, and he was more or less put on to direct me with my gun to show me when we got into centre there, to show me what to shoot at and what not to shoot at, you know, things like that.
Now, the commandos were from Number 1 Commando.
All the rest of the commandos were made up from different commando groups, but on my boat alone, there was all from the Number 1 Commando. The other commandos on the different boats that were spread out amongst the flotilla, we had roughly, say, 14 men to each ML.
Do you remember the names of any of the ones? One of them was Sergeant Durant. Can you talk a bit about him?
Yes, Sergeant Durant was a Royal Engineer before he joined the Commandos, and he's got a brother in the services as well, who won sometime later on in the war, or very early on in the war, before Dunkirk, his brother won an award, I don't know which it was, at Centre's Air itself. It's funny that, how he should win the VC at Centre's Air.
What was he like as a bloke? I mean, I know you didn't know him long, but you knew him.
Long enough to know that he was a good chap to be with as regards being a good comrade and always out for a bit of a lark. And when we went training down to the Scilly Isles, we had some rough weather and the sea was doing a bit of blowing and throwing the sea spray up the nozzle of the gun. Now, on the Ehrlichan guns, you had a little cap that you fitted over the end of the gun to stop the spray going down the gun. And you could fire through it. If you came to come in action fairly quick, you just fired the gun and ignored it. You didn't bother trying to take it off. And my gun was getting pretty wet, and I was looking for some of these covers to put on the gun, and I couldn't find any, which done a lot of firing practice, and so Tommy Duran come up, he says, "Here, put this on," and it was a condom. And so it fitted over the end of the nozzle of the gun quite easy, and But the trouble is, after it had been on a couple of hours, with the guns swinging up and down a bit, some of the seawater that got in the gun come to the end, and it were hanging quite queer on the end of the gun. And our first lieutenant come by and he said, "Battison, what have you got there? What's on that?" He says, "Take it off." He said, "We're going to fight the Germans, not to seduce them." And that was one of Tommy Durand's ideas. Like, anyway, it was out for a lark, yeah.
Good. Who was their officer? Did they have an officer aboard? The commander?
Yeah.
Was there an officer?
Yeah.
Who was
that? We had two. One was Ronald Swain. He was a lieutenant. And also, I believe he was a full lieutenant as well, was the, can't think of his name, because the names are listed different here, but I can give you the names of all the commandos that were on my boat.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, well, they was Tommy Durant, Sergeant, W. Chamberlain, Lance Sergeant, W. A. King, Lance Sergeant, R. Butler, Lance Sergeant, D. Chappell, Lance Sergeant, R. C. Bishop, Private, E. Evans, Corporal, A. H. Dockerell, Lance Sergeant, F. Llewellyn, Corporal, E. Tomlin, Private, A. Hopkins, Private, and Glyn Salisbury, Corporal. They was the men that made up our crew, along with the Lieutenant
Ronald Swain.
Swain.
And the other one whose name you don't remember.
The other one, his name will be in this book, it's just a matter of finding it out.
Well, perhaps they can look that up. What was your opinion? What did you think of Swain? He's quite well known. What was he like as an officer?
He was the same as anything else. We didn't get a chance to know him really well, but I do know when we were coming back from the Scilly Isles, we had a practice shoot. And he came up from below deck and his face was green. He was, you know, he suffered from seasickness. And he come up and when we were going to have a shoot on the deck, he got this gun. I don't know what kind of... Hand gun.
Revolver.
Yeah. And it wasn't like a revolver as we know it. It was more like one of these gangsters kind of guns. And he come up on deck with that, and everybody thought he was going to shoot himself because he got this gun, and he was in the right state. But he carried on with the shooting and that, just same as commandos are trained to do. So he was pretty good in that respect.
Now, you're moving towards the raid, and you got your briefing, I believe, on the Princess Josephine Charlotte.
Josephine Charlotte.
Well, what
yeah.
was that?
That was a commando carrying ship. It was a, normally speaking, it was a cross-channel steamer before the war, but they converted two or three of them to carry commandos about in bulk, you know, and sometimes they used them to take the load and just offload them at that. Other times they used to use them as an holding ship, and then they'd come and join, such as our raid, they'd come and join onto the different boats that were there.
Now, you were briefed on what was going to be called Operation Chariot. Now, what can you remember of that briefing?
It was still very secret. Even then, we didn't know where we were going to. But they took us to on board the Josephine Charlotte to look at this model, and there was only the officers and the gunners, and I believe the coxswain, I believe he was allowed to go. It was just necessary men that was, had to know something about the harbour at St. Nazaire, but they didn't name it. We didn't know what it was. We could see its model and different gun emplacements up and down, and we thought it was on one coastline, you know, where you run up to the coastline. We didn't know it was about 7 or 8 miles up a river. They didn't tell you things like that.
What did they tell you then? Just
well, they told us about these different guns and the best thing to do to tackle them, but there's odd things he told you that just slip your memory at the moment, but we still, after we'd been on board and had a look at this model and seen the different paths, we still didn't know it was St. Nazaire and what St. Nazaire was like.
How many days before you went was this?
2 or 3 days.
And any more training or briefings before you went? Because you went on, you set out, I think, on the 26th of March,
yes.
1942. Anything happened in the sort of couple of days before?
No, it's just plain sailing, a pretty mild sea all the way over.
Well, hang on, before we go, you also were told to put clean underwear on.
Yeah, in case of injury, because if you got dirty underwear on and you got wounded, it tended to spread anything, gangrene or all kinds of things you could get if you hadn't got clean underwear on, and it was always better to wear clean underwear if you knew you was going into action, because you never knew whether you was going to get injured or not. So that's one good thing they told you to do.
Now, so what do you remember of the, when you set out on the 26th of March, what do you remember of that crossing and the ships you were with and what the sort of thing was like?
We're moving in a line that the escort destroyers, the Tynesdale and the Atherston, were two escort destroyers. They weren't to come into St. Nazaire, only to try and get us out after the raid. But up to, they led us off, and the Campbelltown was in the fore, along with the MGB, motor gunboat, which Ryder was on. But he came over on the, either on the Campbelltown or one of the escort destroyers. They could swap about off of one boat onto another if they wanted to.
They were towing the MTB, weren't they?
Yeah, to save fuel and make sure it got there okay.
But the motor launches went...
The motor gunboat, which was Commander Ryder's command ship, and he was on that, and
so anything you remember from the crossing?
Yeah, we just before we got into centre there, we bumped into a load of French fishing boats, and the escort destroyers dashed off to see what were happening, and they thought that the fishing boats could have had Germans on board with radios and that to warn them that we were coming, so they had to make sure about that. And they got two fishing boats separated from the others, and they found out that there was no means of communication with the shore, so they said to them, now these two had seen more of us than anybody, with all these motor launches and the MTB, and they must have known we were quite close to the French coast, and they could have sent signals back to the shore and warned them about us. So they said the best thing you can do is we can sink you and bring you back to England with us. So that's what they did. They sunk these two boats and put the crew, and the French crew were quite happy to go with us. In fact, they were happy to be able to leave Germany, France, occupied Germany. German occupied France, sorry. And they were quite happy to do that, and that's what happened with them.
And the Tyndale ran into a U-boat as well, didn't it? The Tyndale had a fight with a U-boat.
It didn't hang about long, and they tried to fire at it before it submerged. I don't know whether they hit it or not, but I don't think anything ever came of that. I don't think it was sunk, and I don't think it managed to get any messages up about us.
Now, the two destroyers left you, and you started to go up the Loire estuary.
Yeah. We'd already sent a submarine over, one of ours, to guide us away in by showing a light, flashing a light from shoreways to us out at sea, to which was the best place to enter, which it did quite well. I forget the name of the submarine actually now, but
now, how did you feel in yourself during the crossing as you got near the coast, you know, because you hadn't been in action before?
No.
How did you feel?
Well, we felt excited, and we knew that something was going to happen. But even then, only the officers and people in the know actually knew that we were going into Centre's Air. We didn't know it was Centre's Air until after we were taken prisoner.
Were you excited, or were you nervous as well?
Well, I don't think I ever got a chance to get nervous, because there was always something to do, and I'm one of them type of chaps that can keep me cool normally, but some things do get me excited. But I was never afraid, although there was plenty of things going off all around.
The other thing is, you seem to have seen a lot of jellyfish as you approached the coast.
This is the point.
No one's mentioned that much.
The night before, the sea was alight with this phosphorescence coming off the jellyfish.
That's the night you were sailing out?
The night as we were going into Centre's Head.
Right.
And there was millions of them. You were cutting through them, and I've never seen so many, and the actual amount that they were seemed to send this phosphorescent light off from the sea. But I don't know if anybody at Centre's Air has ever mentioned it or anything, but I can remember as well as anything.
Now, on your way in, there was a decoy signal sent in saying that you were a German flotilla with, you know, you've got that in your book, but did you know about that at the time, that they were going to do decoy signals? Or
no, they kept everything as quiet as they could because of the Germans getting to know. I mean, it was bad enough going in there unbeknown to the Germans, because it was such a good defensive harbour, and if they'd have known we were coming, they'd have wiped us off the face of the earth before we even got in Centre there. So they had to have some kind of a game to play with them, and they worked successfully, because we had a signalman on board especially for that reason.
On your boat or on another one?
No, on one of the escort boats. On the Campbelltown, I think. No, sorry. It could have been on Commander Ryder's gunboat. And he sent a signal out in German. We'd cracked the German code for that particular day or day or two, whatever. And this signalman sent messages in German to the shore to tell them that we were a German naval patrol that had been in action with the enemy, and we'd got wounded men on board, and we wanted to bring them into Centre's Air to get treatment in hospital. And it went on for quite a while until we got right up to the Campbelltown to be able to make its last bit of a dash to crash the lock gates.
Now, another part of it, of the approach, was this air raid. There was an air raid launched. Could you see that?
This was laid on by the Air Force. The air raid was laid on with the Air Force to send so many bombers over to bomb the docks in centre there. And also, because they knew we were going there as a commando raid, they didn't want to blow all our lads up in the dock area, so they were supposed to drop one or two bombs and then move further inland and just keep dropping bombs to distract the Germans away from the actual dock area. But they didn't want to damage a lot of civilians in centre there. And as it happened, the weather was that bad for flying and being able to see for mist that after they dropped two or three bombs and alerted all the coastal defences, they moved off and never come back again. So that was a big letdown for us, because it alerted all the Germans to the fact that something was going off, and they were all on the guns ready to have a bash at us when we got in.
Now, what's the next thing? That you were going up the Loire. How wide was the Loire? Could you see either side?
Yeah, until you get right up to the actual area. Yeah, it's a big expanse. If it was dark, but I mean, if it had been in daylight, you'd have been able to see the sea and the coast and things like that.
So now you were strapped into your
gun,
Oerlikon.
The Oerlikon gun, yeah.
So tell me the story as you remember it then, as you started to approach Saint Nazaire docks.
Well, with the bombers coming over and dropping one or two, and the ICAC were firing at them, there was something going off there, shell fire and things like that. And as we gradually closed up to Saint Nazaire itself, we were in line. There were two lines of motor launchers, and the Campbelltown was leading them. That we'd already dropped the Tynesdale and the Atherston off. We'd left them further back before they got in the Bay of Biscay. Well, they was in the Bay of Biscay, but further back from the coast. And we went creeping up. Our boat was about the 8th or 9th in line of
the two lines.
Two lines of boats, port and starboard.
Which we used, port or starboard?
Starboard, left hand, isn't it?
No, port.
Port side, yeah, we're about 9th in line.
How many boats were there in all, motor launches?
I think there were 16.
16 in each line?
No, altogether. I can't remember exactly, as I say, my memories.
It's all right. Well, you couldn't have been 9th in line if there were two lines, that's all I mean, you know. But
We were near the rear. We weren't in actual fact right at the end, but we were pretty close to it. Mostly motor launchers, but there was the MGB and the MTB. And it would make up.
Yeah. So I think if we just take you to the back of the left-hand column.
Yeah.
And what happened next as you start going?
Well, as
in,
we're going in, the signalman on the MGB had managed to, they did open fire and then stopped when he started signalling, and more or less managed to satisfy them that we were a German force, and so they ceased firing. But they were still suspicious, and as we got closer in, the MLs were beginning to slip off to the landing points. There were in two landing points. One at ours was on the old mole, and on the old mole was a concrete block gun gunpoint, and he was firing at everybody in sight. And by the time it came to our point, time to get in, to try and get our men landed on the old mole, by that time there was already started firing again in earnest, and of course we had enough to do firing back at them and keeping busy that way.
So as soon as they opened fire for the second time, you opened fire as well?
Yes. We, up to that time, some of the boats had German swastikas on to make them think we were Germans. But as soon as they opened up and they said open fire, well, it was like all hell let loose then.
Did you open fire as well at the same time?
Oh, yes.
Now, tell me how you were firing, because you weren't firing on your own. You were guided by Lieutenant Landy, weren't you? Tell me how you were working and what you were firing at.
Well, I had a loading number in the gun. It's a round bandstand type of thing. And he was telling me to fire it, pointing my direction of where to fire. But, I mean, he had enough people to aim at in any case. You had enough guns firing at you to know where to fire, and searchlights as well, and there was one of the biggest problems, the searchlights. And as we got closer up, there was boats already being set on fire, and with them being full of petrol, and they didn't take much, and being wooden boats.
I'll come back to that. Stick to what you had, because in your book you've got a lot about how you aimed at the searchlights and went from one to one, and then you concentrated on it. Can you tell us about that, what he was telling you to do?
After we'd been firing at one or two of these searchlights to try and stop them picking out the boats, Landy said, hang on, don't swing away from that setting. Mark it in your mind and keep it there. And then as soon as because the Germans were switching them off when we got a line of fire onto them, and then as soon as we'd swung off them, they'd switch back on and they'd be just as deadly as ever. So Landy said, keep your sights on them, and as soon as they light up again, let them have it. Well, we did that on two or three occasions. And I think must have blown some of them up anyway, but you can't be certain. I mean, it's just like a firework display and you're in the middle of it. And they're firing at you and you're firing at them. And it was a real, well, you don't want to see anything like that again, I'll tell you. It was enough just once.
Now tell me about the... some of the ships ahead of you, the motor launches ahead of you, were burning the water. Now, tell me all about that. What could you see as you went forward?
Well, as we were making our way up to try and land on the old mole, there was these ships set afire. Some of them was actually had that much damage done to them, they were sinking in any case. But the sea area around the old mole was absolutely on fire. There were just odd little patches that weren't blazing. But as we got near to the old mole, one of the boats that had tried to land there started, it was on fire, out of control, and drifting back towards us so that we could not land our men there.
They were wooden boats, weren't they?
You said
that, mahogany.
Yeah.
So they caught fire reasonably easily. I mean, not easily, but...
But with the petrol on board, you see, that was made it worse. Now, our motor mechanic had orders from the skipper, or everybody did, that with these upper-deck petrol tanks, you use them on the way over, and as soon as you'd got near to centre there, you flush them out altogether because the fumes... an empty petrol tank was more easy to set fire than it would if it were full of petrol. And you had to flush them out with seawater, and our motor mechanic did that. And I suspect that a lot of the boats never did that, because she set fire a lot too easily. And Marina's, the reason we didn't set fire, I think, was because our motor mechanic had done that.